bats, 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 funky little bats. Bats are the critters of the night. Fun little butterfly and bulldog bats. Bats know where everything's at.
You don't go funky out.
Rosie Emery gets us going with her bat song to start our show today. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about bats. Several species of bats call Wisconsin home. Actually, eight species, matter of fact. And their importance to our ecosystem is really keenly felt when white nose syndrome devastated some of our local populations, especially the little brown bats. We're told that the bats seem to be making a bit of a comeback in Wisconsin and elsewhere. So that's great news. But I really want to introduce you to Allison Brokaw, a behavioral ecologist. She's a science communicator and the author of this great new book. It's titled The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats. The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats. And the subtitle, Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures, published this year by Timber Press. Allison's currently a postdoc fellow or researcher at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about bats? I think she's got the answer. Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Allison Brokaw, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you describe yourself as a behavioral and sensory ecologist. Maybe you could talk about what that means.
Yeah, so basically, it means I am interested in animal behaviors and how behaviors have evolved and how animals have adapted these behaviors to maximize their ability to get food, find mates, get around, etc. And then the sensory part of that is I'm interested in how they are using their different senses, particularly olfaction, so smell, to do those behaviors.
Yeah, your research, your PhD research had to do with smell, did it not?
Yes. Yeah, I was looking at how fruit bats use their smell to get around.
So did you have how did your interest develop with bats? It's you talk a little bit about it in the beginning of your book.
Yeah. So, I think I didn't even mention this in the book, but I kind of grew up loving animals, knowing I wanted to do wildlife science. We would see bats flying around. I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania. We would see bats flying around at night, kind of in the evenings. And then I did get the chance to see some tropical bats on a field trip to the Virgin Islands and could see them a little bit more up close and just kind of became fascinated. And then as I went to school and started doing, more in-depth research about different animals, about bats, I just realized how much there was still left to learn. And that fascinated me.
Well, I got to tell you, I really enjoyed your book. And for a couple of reasons. One, you're a very good writer. My academic department is life sciences communication. We actually offer a PhD in science communication. So you're a good writer, but the photos, I did want to comment on the photos. They're absolutely fantastic photos. And I remember interviewing Leanne Henyon, who wrote Night Magic, a book you'd probably like. Anyway, we got around to bats, and she was frustrated by the photos that people see of bats. And she said typically those are kind of, they're posed and so forth, and the bats are scared, and they come off looking mean, not scared. And your photos, absolutely fantastic photos, show them more in their natural state, doing pretty much anything imaginable. And when you're finished with the book, you have, I think almost anyone's opinion of bats would change, if not for the writing, certainly for the photos, the visual effect of those photos.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. And I have to say, I can't take credit for most of the photos. A lot of the ones of bats in flight over water are the work of my colleagues and mentors, Brock Fenton, who is a professor in Canada, and then Price Sewell, who is a bat ecologist and consultant. And yeah, they were gracious enough to let me use their stunning photos, which really do show off, yeah, the personality and,
yeah,
you know, the cuteness of these creatures.
Absolutely. Well, this, and you were, how were you prompted to write the book in the first place? I mean, just your love of bats, and you had some opportunity present itself.
Yeah. So, back in, must have been maybe summer of 2021. So kind of, we were still in the midst of the COVID pandemic, you know, height of things. And yeah, Timber Press reached out to me basically saying, you know, we think bats could use some good press. What do you think about writing a book? And I was like, yes, please. and so, yeah, kind of, I'm very grateful for that opportunity and that they thought of me and asked me to do this. And it was a really fun experience.
And you might describe what people are going to find when they go through this book. It's an amazing book about bats, believe me.
yeah, so I tried to, in my head, sort of break it up into sort of three pieces. The sort of first few chapters are kind of about, you know, all the fun facts about bat behavior, about ecology, how they get around, sort of imagining, you know, what if we could be a bat, what would life be kind of like? What would we be experiencing? And then kind of trying to, as much as possible, you know, link what bats are doing, what their behaviors are, to things that are familiar to people. So the way that we interact with each other, bats do a lot of, you know, they have a lot of more similarities to humans and human behavior than we probably realize. And then towards the end, I really wanted to highlight and focus sort of clearing up some of the myths around bats, particularly related to things like disease, and then also really highlight all the important things that bats are doing in our environments and why it's important that we protect them and do what we can to keep them around.
You know, before I started your book, of course, I kind of paged through it, but then I thought, I wonder how many Wisconsin bats are represented in this book. So I went back to your index, and we have 8 species. The big and little browns, we've got tricolored, we've got hoaries, we've got eastern reds, we've got silver-haired, I'm trying to remember them all, evening bats, and the one bat that you didn't have represented out of the 8, only one, which I thought was amazing, was the Keens.
Okay, yeah.
And the Keen is kind of, you know, it's sort of like the little brown. I mean, I don't ever ask me to tell the difference between the two of them. They look pretty much the same and about the same size. I thought you did really good to get 7 out of 8, given all of the work you did. You traveled all over the world for this. I mean, not only for the book, but for your work and for your interest in bats.
Yeah, I've been really fortunate enough to have opportunities to do field work, studying bats specifically in Central America. So I've done field work in Belize and Panama and Mexico, and those places have incredible levels of bat diversity. I believe Mexico is in the top, you know, if you were to list countries by number of bat species they have, I think Mexico is maybe 3 or 4.
Yeah.
It's pretty high up there. And then, yeah, I've also had the opportunity to do various types of bat work around the United States. So I definitely, I mean, the book, I tried really hard to highlight as much as I could bats from around the world, but we all have our biases. And so I definitely talk a lot about bats in North America and in Central America, where I have the most experience.
How many species are there? I've forgotten. And there actually more are being discovered all the time, I guess.
Yeah, so the current count is 1,487 species of bats currently described by science. And you can, the listeners can keep an eye on that number. If you go to batnames.org, that website is run by scientists from the American Museum of Natural History. And every 6 months or so, they update it with all the new species that have been described or redescribed. And so you can actually track that number in almost real time, which I think is really fun.
Yeah. Chuck in Juneau has a question for you. Maybe a tough one to answer. Hi, Chuck.
They update it with all the new stuff that described.
Oh, you're breaking up. I'm sorry to say, but I'll tell you what, I can sort of paraphrase. Chuck has a large old barn with a lot of holes and had a lot of trouble with bats making a mess in the barn. And that'll give us a chance to talk about guano in a minute. But is there any way to get bats to quit coming every year to that large old barn with all those holes?
Yeah, that is definitely a challenge. And unfortunately, there's no perfect answer. There are definitely resources online. Bat Conservation International is a good one for sort of ways that we can minimize that risk. Patching up the holes as much as you can. If you know bats are living in a place, you want to avoid, sealing them up in that place. But there are sort of one-way exits that you can install.
Excluders, I think they're called, yeah.
Yeah, and basically it lets the bats leave, but makes it hard for them to get back in. Unfortunately, bats are very good at squeezing themselves into tight spaces. And then something that people often will try, and I can be met with good success if you've excluded them from an area, is providing an alternative roost. So having a bat box or bat house somewhere nearby keeps them around, keeps them, doing their good works in your neighborhood, but, keeps them out of spaces where you don't want them.
Allison Brokaw, our guest today, her book is The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats, and subtitled Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures. Questions for her, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Allison Brokaw about her book, The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Lynn and Pewaukee emailed to share. They were on a cruise to Australia, stayed overnight in a hotel in Cairns before visiting the Great Barrier Reef the next day. And the guide suggested they enjoy the sunset. So they were on their balcony at sunset, and suddenly thousands of fruit bats came out of the trees to hunt for insects. And Lynn said that was an amazing experience.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. I'm a little jealous. I actually have not made it to Australia yet, and it's on the list of places and bats that I want to see.
You mentioned that in your book, that nearly every unusual mammal behavior you can think of is done by bats. Only a couple of things you mentioned that they don't do.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that I, in particular, am just so fascinated by bats is that diversity. Think of a sort of general behavior, whether it's a diet type. So there's bats that eat insects, which is most bat species in the world. But there's bats that specialize in things like scorpions and, venomous animals or poisonous animals. There's bats that are carnivores, bats that eat other bats. There's bats that live in all sorts of different places.
They're found pretty much everywhere, aren't they? Except Antarctica, I think.
Yeah. I always like to say that pretty much, anywhere most people are traveling, that place, there's going to probably be at least one bat that lives there. And that's true for a lot of island areas as well, because bats can fly. They are really good at dispersing to some of these places that other animals, particularly other mammals, have a hard time getting to. So bats are often the only native mammal on many island areas.
And they're closely related to deer. I think it was whales. They're more closely related to deer and whales and dogs than with birds.
Yeah, so bats are mammals. Kind of they are related to all other mammals, including humans. I always like that fact because I think people often associate bats with rodents because they kind of look similar. They're kind of around the same size. But in terms of the most recent common ancestor and where how we think these mammals evolved, bats are more closely related to dogs and cats and whales than they are to rodents. So they're sky puppies is what I like to say.
Oh, I like that term. That's great. Sky puppies. Eric in Portage has a question. Hi, Eric.
Hey. I built a really beautiful bat house out of cedar a couple years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and I have it on a pole aiming southwest, and so get the most sun, never attracted a single bat.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is...
That's a
yeah,
lament.
It's definitely a challenge. Bats can be picky. It can be hard to know exactly what they're looking for. One of the things I always like to recommend people do if they're wanting to put up a bat house is really look into the species of bat that live in your specific area, because some bats have different preferences. Some bats like it really warm. Some bats like it a little bit less warm. Particularly for Southwest, it's possible, depending on your orientation, that your bat box is actually too warm. So it's something to think about. Sometimes painting the bat boxes has been shown to sort of improve that thermal gradient and put it in a place where bats like it most. So painting your bat box is often linked to success. So if you haven't tried that, it's worth a shot. And then sometimes it's just patience. It can take several years for the bats to find the bat box and decide to use it.
Sometimes people will find some bad guano and put it inside a new box, too. I don't know that that makes that much difference, but something that could be done. Thanks, Eric. Ryan in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love the show. So I have a bat box that I built a couple of years ago, and maybe a 1-inch opening for the bats. It's attracted some wasps. I'm wondering if that will deter the bats. I'm guessing it will, but.
Yeah. What do you think, Allison?
So normally a good practice with having a bat box out is, even if bats haven't moved in yet, is keeping an eye on it and trying to clear out any sort of wasps or anything else that might have kind of moved in. Bats will usually not want to be roommates with those types of critters. So it's a good idea to kind of keep an eye on the maintenance of these boxes as you're waiting for the bats to find them and move in.
And Roger in Wanakee has a bat box question as well. So let's go there. Hi, Roger.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good.
I live town of Westport, north of Madison, in the woods of 4-acre woods, and I have a cedar sided home, and had some carpentry work done. I did have bats in the belfry, but not anymore. What kind of a bat box would I be able to buy locally, and what kind of openings do I need to attract the bats that might be in the southern Wisconsin area?
Southern Wisconsin and woods. Little browns probably.
Yeah, or potentially big browns. It's definitely something Yeah, if you kind of look into the specific ecology of some of the bats known to be in those areas, one thing that can be challenging, especially if you're near a wooded area, is that the bats may already have a great home. So they may not move into a bat box if they've already found a good hollow tree roost or whatnot. So it does depend on the species. There are some good websites that you can find sort of, you know, bat biologist approved bat boxes. Yeah. Merlin Tuttle has some resources that for good brands that you can buy for pre-made ones. Bat Conservation International also has free plans if you wanted to build your own, and they provide a few options for you that you can choose to, depending if you want to mount on the side of a house or on its own pole, and based on the type of bat that might be in your area. So those are some good resources to check out as you're kind of making these decisions.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. Paul in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. I don't know if Allison has heard of this place or maybe been there already, but if anyone wants to have just an amazing bat experience, there's this place over in central Colorado called the Orient Land Trust. And basically, it used to be an old mine. The roof collapsed, and now it's just a giant hole in the ground and is now colonized by some, like, 150,000 migratory bats every year. And so if you go and visit during the summer, every night during, like, sunset, this giant spiral of bats starts emerging from the hole, and they all just fly over your head and spread out into the valley to eat critters and pollinate crops. And, yeah, just an amazing sighting of bats.
And where is it again, Paul?
The Orient Land Trust in the San Juan Valley.
Orient Land Trust in the San Juan Valley. Paul, thanks very much. Allison, I don't think you've been there.
No, I mean,
judging from the look on your face.
Yeah. No, I'm taking notes. Yeah, I haven't heard of that one. I will recommend, if your listeners are traveling and are interested in seeing some of these really incredible bat emergences within the United States. One of my favorite experiences, and it's hard to describe the experience, is Bracken Cave near San Antonio, Texas.
Yeah.
It is the world's largest colony of bats. It is estimated to be between 15 and 20 million individuals at peak summer. And it sounds like it's probably a little bit similar. The bats come out in this spiraling mass. We affectionately refer to it as the Batnado. So it's this bat tornado of individuals come flying out of this kind of sunk in cave, and then go off to hunt for insects over the nearby agricultural fields. And it takes hours for all the bats to leave. The sound is incredible. You just hear the flapping of wings. Mm-hmm. Is just like, yeah, it's a truly immersive experience. That there's a viewing deck, so you're kind of right there. The bats are circling above your head. Highly recommend if you have the chance to check that out. And the people running the preserve that where the cave is found are doing a lot of good work to protect that area, protect those bats. Associated again with Bat Conservation International.
Everybody who I've talked to who has been there, like you, it's almost impossible to describe when they all come out. It's must be an amazing experience. Paul, thank you. Debbie in Reedsburg, your turn. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I had a comment. I just went and bought Allison's book off Amazon. And then I wanted to know how much headway they made on the white nose syndrome for the little brown bats we have here.
Yeah,
that's a great question. So there is some signs of hope, I guess I would say. As I think you mentioned in the intro, we're starting to see, at least in some areas, some stabilizing of the little brown bat population. So for context, white nose syndrome was first described in New York in 2006. and then pretty rapidly spread throughout much of the northeast, eastern coast, and then Midwest of the United States and Canada, and then is still slowly spreading, but it not at quite the same rates, either because of the types of species of bats or their behavior and their ecology. And those, the species, particularly little browns, northern long-eared bats, and tri-colored bats were the hardest hit, experienced really, really rapid population declines. So populations are at least starting to stabilize. We're not seeing the same decline year after year. There is some hope and some evidence that they may be adapting or slowly evolving some kind of resistances, just in terms of, you know, immune response. The hard thing with bats is they reproduce slowly. So many of the bats in North America, including the little browns, only produce one pup a year. So it takes a long time for populations to recover following a decline. So there is some sort of hope. One of the things that that I've been advocating for, and a lot of the bat conservationists that I talk to who are working on this, some of the ideas and the conservation has shifted from, can we find a cure, which seems unlikely. It's just really hard to scale up any kind of vaccine or treatment for bats, and more about how can we support the populations that have survived? What can we do to make it easier for these bats that, you know, have made it through a winter with white nose? What can we do to make it so that they can make it to the next winter and the winter after that? So supporting things like native habitats, preserving areas, that kind of thing, I think is going to be really important moving forward to keeping bats around as much as possible.
Yeah. Debbie, thanks very much for calling. And you just ordered the book while you're listening here. I'm glad you you did. You're going to enjoy it for sure. I just want to go back to the previous caller, that had bats in their 1800s barn. Lisa emailed, there's no way to seal up the openings in a barn like that. Lisa said that she set up lights in the barn and then put up several bat houses outside. And that strategy has been quite successful. And Lisa,
that's great.
She turns on the lights early spring before the bats arrive.
So yeah, that's a great solution. When I'm sort of advocating for like, how can we help bats? One of the things is, can we minimize the lights that we have on? But using lights as a sort of non-invasive tool to help keep bats away from areas you don't want them is a good one, and is definitely more recommended than, more invasive kind of approaches. So
and then
that's great.
That's
great to hear.
Yeah, great to hear. And then she adds the bat houses, so she gives them. And I remember a guy called the show once, and he put up some bat houses, and he said in the summertime he enjoys watching them, those little browns, eat the mosquitoes. As you say in the book, they probably don't eat 1,000 a day.
Yeah. So yeah, that's it's always a challenge when people sort of are excited and are like, bats eat all these mosquitoes. And it's always, I don't want to break your hearts and tell you it's not true, because it's sort of true. Bats do. Some bats are definitely out there eating mosquitoes. And actually, one of my good friends who did her PhD in Wisconsin, shout out Amy Ray, some of her work showed that the little brown bats and the big brown bats in Wisconsin are out there eating mosquitoes. She was doing diet analysis. So it is true. They do some of that work. And I also like to highlight, they're also eating lots of other pests, insects as well. So a lot of garden pests in particular. So things like the beetles and squash bugs and stuff that is likely to eat your, garden tomatoes. Bats are out there eating. And then for kind of more broadly, nationwide agriculture, bats are doing a lot for protecting crops like corn and cotton by eating the moths that that plague some of these types of crops. So even if they're not eating mosquitoes, they're still doing good work to protect us, protect our food.
And go back to that. There, just a little sidebar. Some moths now have developed a different way of making noise when they flap their wings to confuse the bats, an evolving thing, which is an amazing world, isn't it, that we live in?
Millions of years old, what we call an evolutionary arms race, where, you know, the bats have developed a method, echolocation, for hunting down insects. The insects, you know, develop the adaptation to be able to hear the bats coming. They develop or adapt these behaviors like evasive maneuvers, things like if you ever just see a moth just drop out of the sky, that is actually a technique to avoid being captured by something. And then some insects have taken it even farther and, yeah, have developed ways to produce sounds themselves that interfere with bat echolocation and make it so that the bat misjudges where that insect is and misses, basically.
Yeah, and our bats here, all eight of them use they're all insect eaters, so they use echolocation. You have an interesting chapter on echolocation. Sort of three types of sounds? But go ahead and talk about echolocation.
So echolocation, it's a huge topic. It's really fascinating how bats have evolved the use of sound to get around their environment. Something most bats around the world use echolocation to some degree, though there is a whole section of bats that do not have echolocation. And what's really cool about bat echolocation is that because there's so many species doing it, they're really good at it, and there is all this variation in how they use it. So we see variation in the shape of the calls themselves. So what frequencies bats are using, how much they go from one frequency to another. We see bats use what are called frequency modulated calls, where it kind of, you start at one frequency and then, or one pitch, and then slide to a new one. Some bats use constant frequency, where they just are emitting a single pitch for a little bit. And that's really cool because they take advantage of this Doppler compensation effect, which is this property of sound. When we hear a siren go by, it sounds like the pitch is moving. That's actually not true. The pitch is the same, but the movement of the siren makes it sound like it's going up and down. And so bats are able to take advantage of that property of sound to improve their ability to capture insects, which is just like, I don't know, blows my mind. I could really dive into a lot of the nitty gritty of the echolocation, and we would be here for the rest of the afternoon. They're really good at it. They do a lot of really interesting things with sound. And it's just really fascinating the way that they've evolved these behaviors to.
Yeah. Another, you address, Wameng sent us an email, and whoops, my screen just jumped. I've got it back now. Why do bats carry so many different diseases, such as rabies and Ebola and so forth? And you had really straight on addressed that.
Yeah. So one thing I always like to remind people is that, yes, it is true that bats carry diseases, but so does every other animal that exists. Humans carry tons of diseases, and we are more likely to get diseases from each other than we are from wildlife like bats. And then on the flip side, it is true that bats have some really interesting adaptations in terms of their physiology and their cell pathways and mechanisms and the way that their bodies signal immune responses that have made it so that they may not get as sick from certain types of viruses. which is something that we can learn from. So if we can understand, you know, what kind of cellular pathway, what sort of molecules are the cells releasing inside of a bat to respond to, you know, an invading virus or bacteria, and how do bats minimize the side effects? How do they minimize inflammation? Mm-hmm. How do they minimize fever and the effects on their body? If we can take it, if we can learn that, we can take advantage of that and potentially, you know, develop treatments that sort of mimic those properties. And as far as rabies, I always like to also just throw out there that all mammals are susceptible to rabies. So as mammals, bats are not an exception to that rule. And with rabies in particular, it's hard because rabies is not something you want to mess with. If you suspect a rabies encounter, definitely consult your doctor. Don't wait. But only like 5% of bats that have been submitted for testing each year to organizations like the CDC come back as positive for rabies, whereas close to 20% of animals like raccoons and skunks and foxes that have been submitted for testing come back positive for rabies. So the actual incidence of rabies in bats is fairly low. Mm-hmm. And the best way to avoid it is just, you know, don't handle and interact with wildlife if you don't have to. That's the best way to stay safe, both for you and for the animals.
Bill in Oregon, Wisconsin, emailed to say they've been doing acoustic bat monitoring in their neighborhood for many years. A few years ago, Bill expanded their monitoring season into October and November. They've been quite surprised by the ebbs and flows of bats as a migrating species. And as he wonders, has anyone come up with a good way to study the movement behaviors of our migratory bats? In Wisconsin, Bill believes we only have a couple of two full-time acoustic monitoring stations that contribute to our knowledge of bat behavior, migration.
Oh, that is an awesome question. So studying migratory bats is a huge challenge and has been for a long time. Bats are, they fly and they're small. So it's hard to put transmitters, radio collars, those types of things on them because any weight you put on a bat, that bat now has to carry that around. And so we try to minimize that kind of impact. But they're in the past, just even past 5 years or so, even since I've been involved in bat research, there have been a lot of technological advances to be able to track bats, especially migratory ones. I was lucky enough to be involved with some migratory bat research in Northern California using sort of geolocators that only took a couple points. We had to get those back to get the data. But now people are using these MODIS towers. So it's taking advantage of sort of existing infrastructure for like cell phones and GPS and sort of trying to tap into some of those types of technologies. So if instead of us having to, you know, be in a plane following a bat around to figure out where it's going, we can start to get these more passive, you know, pings of saying like, hey, the bat that has this tag was near this tower on these days, and sort of makes it easier to get a larger data set and of specific locations. So definitely like a space to keep watching as we advance our tech and figure out how to solve some of these challenges.
Allison Brokaw, our guest today, her book is The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats, Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. WPR's one-day winter member drive is tomorrow, and we have a special challenge in effect right now. When 600 people donate before midnight tonight, a group of generous members will donate an extra $10,000. Still room for your gift. Go to WPR.org/donate. Talking with Allison Brokaw about bats and her book, The Weird and Wonderful World of Bats, Demystifying These Often Misunderstood Creatures. Great to have her with us today. It's a fascinating book. Dale and Baldwin had something to add, I believe. Dale, hi.
Yes, sir. All right. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Great show. I wanted to share with you another awesome, awesome bat experience. There is a bridge in Austin, Texas, called the Ann W. Richards Bridge. And every night, over 1.5 million bats migrate there each year. They're Mexican free-tailed bats and put on an awesome show every night at dusk. It actually draws an estimated over 100,000 tourists each year go specifically just to watch the bats.
Oh, Dale, thank you. And Allison, have you been there?
I have, yeah, several times. Yeah, no, that's a great, I'm glad they mentioned that. That is a great spot to see bats. And it's great as a sort of conservation story, because I believe kind of at some point in the last 20 or so years, the city of Austin actually wasn't really that thrilled to have these bats living in this bridge. And through the work of bat advocates and conservationists, they really kind of helped change the city's mind. And now the city has really embraced it as, yeah, tourism opportunity. It brings people to the city. You know, not just these bats are going out and eating lots of insects and doing their thing in the areas around Austin, but yeah, that it's kind of become this sort of something that makes Austin special. And I love that as a... Yeah. Somebody, you know, wants to advocate for bats as much as possible.
Yeah. Thanks, Dale, for calling. Jan in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I've had a very happy cohabitation with bats at my rustic cabin in the woods of eastern Pennsylvania. They live at the top of the chimney inside. And I'm wondering, is there any reason for me not to continue this happy relationship? And... If there's no reason not to, how can I help them? I don't know what kind they are. They are small and they are brown.
Unfortunately or fortunately, a lot of the bats in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, they're kind of all small and brown. but yeah, that's great. I love that you're, wanting to continue to coexist. I think if it's working for you, I think it's fine. I would just recommend making sure that, you know, where the bats are living is separated from where people are living, just to avoid potential interactions. But if it's working and everyone's able to stay safe, then that's great. Kind of just continuing to, provide different habitats, whether it's roosting habitat or things like planting native plants in your gardens that are going to support native insects that are going to attract the native bats. Putting like water sources out can be really great for helping support bats, especially in like summertime when we maybe aren't getting as much rain. There's a lot of really simple things people can do to support bats without necessarily having to live with them if they don't want to.
Yeah. Thanks, Jan, for calling. Appreciate it. Tim in Blue Mounds, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Tim.
Well, hey there, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Just a crazy story from many years ago when I first moved up to Wisconsin about 25 years ago. I lived in a bat house. Now, that might take some explaining, but I came up here with my cat that I called Kitty, and we moved into this A-frame that was covered with cedar-shaped shingles. And it had a porch out front with a railing on it that was about, maybe 4 feet away from the way the roof came down. And every night when the sun went down, all these little bats would come climbing out from underneath the shingles on the side of this old house. And the poor cat was always trying to catch him. And one night he jumped up on the porch railing And you could see the bats coming around him while he tried to catch him. And I swear it looked like he was practicing some kind of Tai Chi or something.
Okay. Well, I'm glad the cat didn't catch any. For sure, Tim. Thank you so much for that story. The ecological roles. I think some of our listeners, many of them, are familiar with some of the roles that bats play here in Wisconsin with our insect eaters. They play, and they probably have other advantages as well for us in the field of agriculture.
So we've talked a lot about the insect eaters, as that is most of what we find in North America. That's what you find in Wisconsin. Bats are also doing a lot of other important, what we call ecosystem services. So things that kind of help ecosystems, help humans, and that includes pollinating. So there are many species of bats, mostly in tropical regions, though there are a few pollinator bats found in sort of the southwest and southern United States as you get closer to Mexico. So they help plants reproduce. And this does include commercially important plants. One that listeners might be familiar with or have at least heard of would be bats are a primary pollinator for agave, which is where we get tequila from. So they're actually really important for pollinating that plant. They also pollinate many other sort of tropical fruits that have really important commercial values, especially in places like Asia and Africa. This includes durian, jackfruit. Another one that listeners might encounter in the United States is dragon fruit. Bats are a pollinator of that species as well, which is a major Mexican commercial crop. And then bats are also important seed dispersers. So our fruit bats, after they've eaten a fruit and they fly to a new place, they help disperse the seeds of that fruit. And that can be really important for maintaining genetic diversity of these plants, and also just helping with things like reforestation, helping replant areas that may have lost trees and that kind of thing, which, you know, is also going to benefit humans for lots of reasons.
Yeah. What's been the buzz around your book? I mean, is it doing well? Have you gotten some good positive feedback?
Yeah, I think so. I've had a chance to talk to a lot of people like you, which has been amazing. And it's always great to hear, the stories like the ones people have been calling in about curiosity and interest and support in bats. And honestly, not very much. I get very few comments these days about how bats are scary or how people don't like them. And that just makes me really happy. It means all the work that myself and other bat communicators and scientists are doing, is working. We're just trying to spread the love.
Well, you've done a really good job with this book. I can tell you that for free.
Thank you. The
Weird and Wonderful World of Bats is the title. Allison Brokaw is the author. And it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I could talk about bats for forever, so
well,
not a problem.
And I can tell you, we didn't touch we touched a very small part of your book, and so there's lots more in store for those who pick up a copy. Thanks, Allison. Coming up, we're going to take a look at solar energy with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Funky little bats, bats are the critters of the night.